This week we have a double bill for you. The stories of Dwight D. Wyman and Max Gordon. Two showmen who never worked together, had strikingly dissimilar backgrounds, and yet were alike in a great many ways. Certainly each gave employment to the greatest talent of their day. And to give you an idea of just how gifted some of their employees were, we offer a Wyman-Gordon overture. A mixed medley of songs from shows presented by two master showmen.
When there's a shine on your shoes, there's a melody in your heart, with a singable happy feeling, a wonderful way to start. When there's a shine on your shoes, there's a melody in your heart, what a wonderful way to start the day.
She didn't say yes, she didn't say no. She only knew her feet spied her there, and then she knew he sat beside her there.
They said someday you'll find all who love are blind. When your heart's on fire,
bother with people I hate. That's why the lady is a tramp. I don't like crap games with barons and earls. Won't go to Harlem in ermine and pearls. Won't dish the dirt with the rest of the girls. That's why the lady is a tramp.
A mere sprinkling of songs from shows produced by Dwight D. Wyman and Max Gordon. Wyman was born in 1895 and Gordon 3 years earlier in 1892. Wyman was a rich Irish boy from the Middle West, Gordon a poor Jewish boy from the Lower East Side of New York. Wyman was orphaned at an early age and Gordon was from a close-knit, loving family. Both had a passionate love of the theatre and innate good taste, and each began his producing career by putting on a sophisticated revue. Well, let's deal with Dwight D. Wyman first. The riches I referred to just now came from the family business, Deere and Company, manufacturers of ploughs and other farm implements. Young Dwight was incurably stage-struck from the age of 9 when he saw his first play in Chicago. He received his early education at the famous Todd School in Woodstock, Illinois, which had a fine drama department, and then there was to be more dabbling in the drama when he moved on to Yale University. He was expected to go into the family business. In fact, it was all mapped out for him. He'd start in the sales and accounting department and work his way up to assistant secretary and later director. Instead, the handsome young man went into show business, presenting no fewer than 11 plays before having a hit. Finally, in 1929, he and Tom Weatherly put on a revue called The Little Show. Most of the songs were by Howard Dietz and Arthur Schwartz.
I played him a lot of songs which had lyrics by various amateur people. And Weatherly said, I like your music very much, but I don't think much of the lyrics. You should be working with a man by the name of Howard Dietz, who has a composer that I don't like musically. And I'll put you together with him, and he did. And we wrote half of the first Little Show, because there were several other ones. And the big hit of that show was later on a hit, and not at the time of the performance of the show. I guess I'll have to change my plan. And that was the first song hit that Dietz and I had.
I guess I'll have to change my plan. I should have realized there'd be another man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself up on the shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground. I've lost the one girl I've found.
I remember this about that show, that Dietz and I missed the opening performance out of town in Atlantic City because our train was behind a wrecked train. And we got to the theater, to the stage door, at the very moment when the curtain had come down. And the first person I saw in that little hallway that you come in from the stage door was Dwight Wyman talking with George White, a great experienced musical producer. And what I heard first from George White, speaking to Dwight Wyman, was this sentence: Dwight, you can save the scenery for some other show. And our hearts fell to the ground. We thought it was a sure flop and went to bed thinking so, not having seen the show at all. The next day was a matinee, and we saw the show, and Dietz instantly found what was wrong with the show. He had written a song with Ralph Ranger, who later became very, very successful writing songs for Hollywood. And it was a sensational scene. It was called Moanin' Low, Clifton Webb and Libby Holman. Clifton Webb, who later became a movie star. And it was so successful that nothing could follow it. And it was in the first act. So Dietz said to Wyman, put that as close to the end of the performance as you can tonight after the matinee and see what happens. And it changed the show from a flop to a hit because nothing could follow it except the end of the show. Dietz was right. And from that moment on, the show was successful and made our careers start. We had a great deal of run from it and a great deal of pleasure.
Moaning low, my sweet man, I love him so, though he's mean as can be. He's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me. Gonna die if sweet man should pass me by. If I die, where'll he be? He's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me.
The Little Show played for 321 performances, a healthy run for the time. After which, Wyman and his partners decided to present a sequel called, of all things, The Second Little Show. Arthur Schwartz missed the first night out of town.
I remember that I didn't see the opening in Boston because I was having an appendicitis operation in a hospital. And Dietz was there, and he called me up and said, you didn't miss a thing. And I said, well, were there any song hits? I said, none of ours, he said. Yes, there's a song by Herman Hupfeld called Sing Something Simple. I don't know whether that song ever reached England. Sing Something Simple. Da 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 da. It was a raging hit in America.
Sing something simple, a little ditty that's sweet and simple. You'll get the swing of it soon, for here's a tune that any child can sing. D stands for dimple, the words are silly, the song is simple. And after hearing it once, the dumbest drunk can memorize a thing. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do, you can't go wrong. Oh, say, it's bound to sound like some other song. But Lord knows it's simple, so get together and let's be simple. I don't know whether or not you knew they call it classic, I Love You.
Rum-tiddly-bum-bum.
Come on, you collar, vocalize.
Bum-bum-bum, rum-tiddly-bum-bum.
Undo your collars and your ties. Even though you never sang a note before, even though you stutter or your throat is sore.
Doctors, lawyers, bankers, all you women of society,
Forget your high position and away with all propriety.
Sing up like a birdie on a perch.
Like a congregation in a church.
Sing song simple. It doesn't make any sense, it's simple. They say the man in the moon will marry soon. George Washington is dead.
D stands for dimple. Without the S we could not say simple. I know a fellow who threads a needle now without a piece of thread.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do. You can't go wrong.
Do, si, la, sol, fa, mi, re, do.
A silly song.
But Lord knows it's simple.
So get together and let's be simple. And when you finish the song, you're through.
That's why they call it
I love you, I love you,
I love you, I love you.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do.
When Dwight D. Wyman failed to rehire his three Little Show stars for the sequel, Max Gordon saw his chance to become a Broadway producer.
I had never done a review. I had done a review in vaudeville, but not one of Broadway standard. And I got a hold of the authors, and I convinced them that I would give them a fine production, which I did. Three's a Crowd, with Clifton Webb, Libby Holman, and Fred Allen. I don't remember the titles, but it was regarded as a great review.
That it was. Three's a Crowd established Max Gordon as a top Broadway producer the very first time out. Now, what did Arthur Schwartz think of his new boss?
Max Gordon was a real character. His whole life was the theater, and his whole vocabulary was theatrical. For example, I remember one thing. Someone asked Max in my presence, Max, do you believe in reincarnation? He said, certainly. I can't believe that we close here and don't open somewhere else. He was very blunt and very strange and eccentric in the way he expressed himself. A man gave him a play to read set in 16th century England and came to find out Max's reaction to it. He said, I don't like it. I'm not going to do it. Said, why not? He said, I don't like any play where a fellow signs a letter with a feather.
One of Libby Holman's songs in Three's a Crowd came to the show in a rather roundabout way. It was written by an American composer who could only get it played in England. Luckily, that's where Arthur Schwartz heard it. The song, Body and Soul, the composer, Johnny Green.
I must say about Arthur and Howard, they were always tremendously objective and terribly honest. And they had been unable to come up with a song that they felt was a proper follow-up to Moan and Low. And Arthur happened to be in England at that time. This is just prior to Three's a Crowd going into rehearsal. And he heard Body and Soul over there, where it had become a big, big hit, but hadn't reached the States yet. And he cabled Max, saying, I found it. I've got the greatest song for Libby that ever was, whatever he said in the wire. And that's how it happened.
My heart is sad and lonely. For you I sigh, for you, dear only. Why haven't you seen? I'm all for you, body and soul. I spend my days in longing and wondering why it's me you're wronging. I tell you, I'm the taking.
after Three's a Crowd, Dietz said to Gordon, Arthur and I would like to do another show with you, and we would like to write the whole score and not have any interpolations by anybody else. That was agreeable to Gordon. Dietz said, I'd like to have George Kaufman, who is a very fine playwright, write the sketches with me or alone, whichever he would like. And so we all did get together. Max Gordon said, well, who would you like to star in this? I said, Fred Astaire and Adele Astaire. They had just failed in a Ziegfeld book show. So Dietz and I went to see Fred Astaire in the dressing room at the Ziegfeld Theater and told him we'd like to have him in a review because he had never been in a review. He actually was the lesser of the two partners. Adele was the comedian. She had all the funny things. And Fred was the man in the dinner jacket and top hat and stick and was that kind of man without really any relation to comedy. Dietz believed that Astaire could play all sorts of comedy, and it proved true. Anyway, the deal was made. They did do the show, and it was our greatest success. And it was Max Gordon, again, who did it. And we called him up one day when he had written five or six songs for The Bandwagon, which was produced in 1931, which is not quite the bottom of the Depression, but nearly. And he heard these songs and stood in the curve of this grand piano, smiling and beaming. And when we finished the five or six, he banged his hand on the piano and said, it's positively a pleasure to go broke with you guys. Well, he didn't go broke. He made a lot of money on the show.
I love Louisa, Louisa loves me. When we rode on the merry-go-round, I kissed Louisa. And then Louisa, Louisa kissed me. We were so happy and free.
Ah, but she's a beautiful Louisa.
Ah, when I choose them, I never want to lose them.
Someday, Louisa, Louisa will be
more as just a fräulein to me. A Frenchman love a glass of wine.
Oh,
the English think the whiskey's fine.
Oh,
when I comb off all the foam off, I bring a toast to the Germans and the Mädchen I love the most. Ich lieb Louisa, Louisa liebt mich. Wenn wir auch zum Ringspiel gehen, ich küss Louisa. Und dann Louisa, Louisa küsst mich. Wir sind so glücklich, so glücklich.
Was sind wir?
Ach, ach, but she's a
beautiful
Louisa.
Ach, when I choose them, I never want to lose them.
The press raved about the show. The New York Graphics headline was, New Review is Without a Flaw. The Evening News trumpeted, The Bandwagon Starts Something, but then there was Max Gordon's favorite.
I'll never forget Brooks Atkinson, who was the critic of the Times, saying, a new era. And it was a new era. The Bandwagon was unlike any review that had been produced up to that time.
In addition to Fred and Adele Astaire, the shimmering cast of The Bandwagon included two brilliant comedy character actors, Frank Morgan and Helen Broderick, and two fine dancers, Tilly Losh and Nono Otero.
If anybody could compete with Ziegfeld as far as quality is concerned, everything being perfect and wanting everything to be just so, it was Max Gordon. He knew a great deal about the theater.
Nono, which number were you particularly associated with in Bandwagon?
I danced to Dancing in the Dark. It was a very famous number.
Thank you.
Dancing in the Dark is still our most performed song and best known all over the world. And I thought that practically everybody knew it who knew songs of the past. Until about 6 months ago, I was in New York on one of my trips, and I recorded for a recording company a few of my songs, and one of them was Dancing in the Dark. The young man who was the sound engineer looked to me like a young man of 17 or 18. He was very efficient, very pleasant. And we finished the session, and he gave me the tape. And as he gave it to me, he said, "Mr. Schwartz, did you write Dancing in the Dark?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, good luck with it."
Ah, youth. Max Gordon, like many of us, has problems with his memory, but not about things which really matter.
I can't remember the names of my most intimate friends now. I can't remember what happened yesterday, but I can tell you what happened 60 years ago with a show which inspired me. I was sitting in the gallery, and I heard every word of a show called Tonight's the Night. And I said to Mr. Berman, A. Berman, who was my lawyer, I said, if only I could produce a show like that. And when I produced The Bandwagon, I said to this A. Berman, I said, well, this is it. I've done it. After The Bandwagon, I met Jerome Kern, and Jerome Kern said, you know, you're the great white hope.
Max Gordon's White Hope status continued when he had his third success in a row with the Kern musical The Cat and the Fiddle. The critics were rapturous. Said one, "Broadway has not heard lovelier music in all its life." Another wrote, "It is so drenched in melody that it is an unfailing delight." And a third said, "Unquestionably the star of this wondrous entertainment is Jerome Kern."
And he wrote his best score with The Cat and the Fiddle. She didn't say yes, she didn't say no, and oh, any number of songs. The Night Was Made for Love.
The night was made for love. The night was made for love. The day has eyes for sweet, delicate charms. But nighttime sighs for strong, hungry arms will lovingly hold you while tulips on fire have ardently told you of sweet desire. For like a
meanwhile, back at White Deer Wyman. He next presented The Gay Divorce. Well, today that sounds like a show about the parting of Larry, Grayson and Everard, but in innocent 1932, it suggested just what it was, an entirely escapist farce with music. Luckily, that music was in the practiced hands of Cole Porter.
After you, who could supply my sky of blue? After you, could I love? After you, why should I take the time to try? Or who else could qualify? After you, who hold my hand and swear you'll never cease to care? For without you there, what would I do? I could search years, but who else could change my tears into laughter after you?
Fred Astaire, Max Gordon's erstwhile Bandwagon star, now working for Wyman. The Gay Divorce was Astaire's last Broadway show. Soon he would be starring in the film version of Max Gordon's next musical comedy, which was called...
Roberta, where I discovered Bob Hope. Bob Hope was playing the Palace Theater, playing four shows a day.
And Jerome Kern and Otto Harbach and Max came over to see me and decided that I would be okay for the show. But it was a super show, and a super show for me, because I had a great part, and I was running all the way through it, and had a chance to do a lot of things. Madame Roberta had a fashion house, and I played with my band at the place, and George Murphy, of course, was my manager in the show. Fred McMurray was in my band.
The band was with Lisa Crowd, and we put them in Roberta. It was a great score. It was a wonderful score. Yesterday was one of the songs. And Faye Templeton, who was a great star, she did this with this big fat actor who became a big star in pictures.
The big fat actor was Sidney Greenstreet, who had a minor role. Faye Templeton, who had been a star for nearly 50 years, came out of retirement to play the title role of Madame Roberta, the elderly owner of a dressmaking salon in Paris. It was her farewell appearance. When the show first opened in Philadelphia under the title Gowns by Roberta, it had such a catastrophic reception that Max Gordon scrapped all the costumes and scenery and brought in a new director as well. When the tarted-up, restaged result hit Broadway, it received a chilly welcome. One critic, Robert Garland of the New York World Telegraph, wrote, "There's no tune you can whistle when you leave the theater. I tried to pucker on the one about smoke getting in your eyes, but it turned out to be the last roundup before I reached the sidewalk." Well, it was thanks to the success of this great song that Roberta became a hit.
They asked me how I knew.
Max Gordon, of course, was a fantastic Broadway producer, you know. And one time he had something like four hits. Dodsworth, a show with Roland Young. And he told me a great story about his mother. He used to go up in the Bronx and have breakfast with his mother on Sundays. And he was sitting up there one Sunday. He says, "Mother, do you know I have four hits on Broadway?" And she said, "Max, is it honest?"
One of the four hits Gordon had in 1934 was The Great Waltz. The Great Waltz was the London hit Waltzes from Vienna with a facelift. A new libretto had been written by Moss Hart, and massive sums were spent to make it the most opulent operetta yet seen.
It cost $247,000. You couldn't possibly do that show for under $1.5 million now, because it would cost $100,000 to move that production into the theater.
To raise that bank-boggling $247,000, Gordon went to the Rockefeller family, a move which was to be documented by Cole Porter in a famous song later that year.
When Rockefeller still can hoard enough money to let Max Gordon produce his show, anything goes.
The following year, in 1935, Porter and Gordon were to work together on the show Jubilee. The libretto of the show was written by Moss Hart, whose widow, Kitty Carlyle, recalls a problem her husband had with the terribly social Mr. Porter.
He told me once that Cole would start coming to rehearsals with a group of friends, and the cocktail shaker, and the butler, and the hors d'oeuvres, and sit in the third row, and they would chat with each other. And he was enraged by this, because he was terribly professional. So he didn't know what to do. After all, Cole was the composer and the lyricist. So he said to the actors, "The next time Mr. Porter arrives with his friends, I want you all to whisper so that not one word will come over the footlights." Cole got the message and never came back.
It was just one of those things, one of those crazy flings, one of those bells that now and then rings, one of those things. It was just one of those nights, one of those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, one of those things. If we thought of it, of the end of it, when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, and amen. Here's hoping we'll be now and then. It was great fun, but it was just one of those things.
No, we haven't forgotten Dwight D. Wyman. In 1936, he presented his first musical since the gay divorce 4 years earlier. This one was a milestone, the first major musical to use ballet as an integral part of the story. Originally, the show had been planned as a film. Rogers and Hart dreamed up the idea for Fred Astaire, but he couldn't or wouldn't do it, and eventually it was done by Ray Bolger, and the show was called On Your Toes.
See the pretty apple top of the tree, the higher up the sweeter it grows. Picking fruit you've gotta be up on your toes. See the pretty penthouse top of the roof, the higher up the higher rent goes. Get that dough, don't be a goose, up on your toes. They climb the clouds to come through with their mail, to dance. Top of the crop, you wanna know the way the wind blows? Then, my boy, you'd better hop up on your toes, up on your toes.
The exciting, innovative dances in On Your Toes were created by the wonder man of the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, Georges Balanchine. Ray Bolger, who reached stardom in the role of the young dancer Phil Dolan, is as much in awe of him today as he was in 1936.
As you know, Georges Balanchine today is considered the number one choreographer in the United States. I have a feeling that he's comparable to anyone in the world. The basic music were two ballets. One ballet, the important ballet, which was the culmination of the show, and the denouement was called Slaughter on 10th Avenue.
In Incidentally, George Balanchine's billing for On Your Toes referred to him as a choreographer. And this was the first time that credit line was used on Broadway. Up until then, Dances By was the standard billing. Choosing Balanchine was Lorenz Hart's idea, and Rogers had no idea how to work with him. He asked Balanchine which ought to come first, the dance steps or the music. The reply was brief. You write, I make. On Your Toes began its successful run in April 1936, and the following April, the team of Wyman, Rogers and Hart handed Broadway another spring tonic, Babes in Arms. Now, Babes in Arms was charged throughout with youthful high spirits. Alfred Drake, who 13 years later would create the role of Curly in Rogers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, was a member of that young cast.
I think that it was a cast of so many youngsters that aside from the four or five character actors, I was the oldest one at the age of 22. I remember auditioning for it. I was very nervous. And I had never been told that Richard Rogers did not like his songs to be used for auditions. So I stood up to sing a song of his, which is a song that I'm particularly fond of, called With a Song in My Heart. And I sang the very first phrase only, and a voice from out front said, thank you, that's enough. And I dismally started to walk off stage when the same voice said, would you come down here, please? And to my amazement, I had the job. I first met Larry Hart, really, and admired him tremendously. He was a brilliant man, a witty man, a very gentle person. And then met Richard, and I was a little bit afraid of him. Richard had a sharp wit, almost caustic. I don't think in those days he was willing to let anyone get very close to him, certainly not a youngster, fresh out of the chorus. Mr. Wyman was very reserved. He had a flashing smile, marvelous teeth, and one saw it quite often, but one didn't know what was behind it.
Probably sheer delight. Now, I doubt if even a producer with Ken Dodd's teeth could resist smiling with a score like that under his banner. More standards came from Babes in Arms than from any other Rogers and Hart show.
It seems we stood and talked like this before. We looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or when. The clothes you're wearing are the clothes you wore. The smile you were smiling then, but I can't remember where or when. Some things that happen for the first time seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we have met before and laughed before and loved before. But who knows where or when?
There must have been rumors along Broadway in the late 30s that Richard Rogers, Lorenz Hart, and Dwight Wyman had made a deal with the devil. For the very next spring, they scored the hat trick, which was also their biggest smash yet. I Married an Angel. To direct I Married an Angel, Dwight Wyman chose a talented young southerner who'd never directed a musical before, Joshua Logan.
Dwight Dear Wyman is the reason that I'm in this business. If it weren't for Dwight Wyman, I never would have gotten where I am or gotten started. He's the first one who offered me a play to do that had not been turned down by Jed Harris and George Abbott and all the big shots. I was a kid, and he handed me a play, offered it to me for the first time, called On Borrowed Time. And On Borrowed Time made me a director. He was a Yale man and very conscious of the fact that he loved Yale. He was, as they say, gung-ho about it. He, you know, went to all the Yale games, and he was a very, very rich man. He was the John Deere Plow Company. And he was married to Steve Wyman, who was another very wealthy family. They had four beautiful daughters, absolutely ravishing daughters. I, of course, used most of them in plays later. But Dwight and I were a sort of a team. He was a producer, and I was a director for years and years. I did On Borrowed Time, and right on top of that, Stars in Your Eyes, I Married an Angel.
I Married an Angel was the fanciful tale of a Hungarian nobleman who becomes so disenchanted with women he vows he will only marry an angel. And when one actually flies through his window, he does marry her, with highly amusing results. Highly melodic, too. Joshua Logan recalls Wyman's favorite song from the score.
Spring is Here. He got so excited about that tune, it forced him to do that play. he wanted to hear that tune sung. But of course, Spring Is Here is a most beautiful song.
Spring is here. Why doesn't my heart go dancing?
What of Max Gordon? Well, in 1939, he presented Very Warm for May, the first Kern Hammerstein show in 8 years. Oscar Hammerstein's libretto was about the stage-struck children of old showbiz troupers who get together to put on a show. Well, not surprisingly, most of the critics found such a plot somewhat wanting. Brooks Atkinson of the New York Times wrote, "Very Warm for May is not so hot." Richard Watts Jr. of the Herald Tribune went further, complaining, "The score seems surprisingly undistinguished." In spite of some other good songs and a talented cast, which included Eve Arden, Vera Ellen, and June Allison, Very Warm for May had a dismal run of only 59 performances. And 1939 was a bad year for Dwight Wyman, too. He presented a show called Stars in Your Eyes, which also didn't do very well. However, one of the noteworthy features of Stars in Your Eyes was the appearance of the Russian ballerina Tamara Tumanova.
Monsieur Wyman was what we call a true gentleman of the theater. I don't think there is not one bad word ever told about him. He invited me to star with Ethel Merman and Jimmy Durante in Stars in Your Eyes. It was a musical comedy show where I played and danced. It was a very difficult thing because it was only the very beginning where Broadway was beginning to have true classical dancing. So we had to sort of bring it out so the audience would understand that there is not only tap dancing, but there is also classical. And I did. I did very pure classical variation with 32 fouettés. But on top of that, I did many other numbers, all on points, and one of them was a rumba on points. Imagine how funny life is. And it brought me off also a tremendous rapport toward a different kind of audience.
One man who never stopped predicting Tamanova would have this rapport with the audience was, not surprisingly, her agent, Milton Bender. Although his client had never acted in English before and had an accent that was then just about impenetrable, Bender kept assuring everyone all through rehearsals that she'd be marvelous. On the show's opening night in New Haven, Tamanova's first appearance received such rapturous applause that Bender turned to Ethel Merman in the wings and said,
I said she was great, didn't I? Well, now even I believe it.
Now, the following year, Wyman presented his fourth springtime Rodgers and Hart show, Higher and Higher. But suddenly, spring turned into winter. The team had their first joint flop. And while Dwight Wyman and Richard Rodgers were watching Higher and Higher sink lower and lower, Rodgers' future partner, Oscar Hammerstein, also had a flop on his hands. Called Sunny River, it was presented by Max Gordon, but not for long. Gordon had similar luck, or lack of it, with his next two musicals, which ran only 96 performances between them. In the final years of his career, Max did rather better with non-musical productions.
The last eight plays that I did were all hits. Sister Eileen, Junior Miss, The Doe Girls, The Late George Apley, Over 21, Born Yesterday, Years Ago, and The Solid Gold Cadillac. I missed the theater because I think, well, everybody said, well, you've done enough. What do you want to get mixed up? It's so expensive and so forth.
Like Max Gordon, Dwight D. Wyman also ended his career as a producer with a straight play. The hit show, The Country Girl. But before they both forsook the musical theater, both men, as we've heard, had successful associations with Cole Porter, who wrote this for Max Gordon's Jubilee.
When they begin, the beginning, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the palms seem to be swaying. When they begin, the beginning, so the dead desire I only remember. When they begin, the beginning.
Begin, the beginning.
For a final word on Dwight D. Wyman, who died in 1951, we turn to the distinguished critic, Brooks Atkinson.
Dwight D. Wyman was a marvelous guy with lots of goodwill. He wasn't trying to make a fortune out of the theater. He was giving a fortune to the theater. He loved the theater, and he loved everything about it.
An affection wholeheartedly shared by Max Gordon. And no one could better express that affection than Max Gordon himself.
Curiously, I've watched bridge played for years. I don't understand it. I don't understand pinochle. I never could understand algebra. I could never figure out that the square on the right angle of a triangle, the hypotenuse on the right angle of a triangle, is equal to the sums of the other two sides. I think that's it. But I had to copy it out of the book. I had to memorize it. I couldn't figure it out for myself. I could never be interested in anything but the theater.
Michael Craig presented The American Showman, which was researched by Bill Sullivan and written by Dick Vosper. The producer was David Raven Allen. And now, Benny Green with a few words.
Max Gordon and Dwight Wyman both began their careers back in what some people like to think of as the good old days. They were good in at least one respect, that you could produce a new show without getting yourself involved in the national debt. But by the time next week's showman broke into the racket, production costs were already beginning to climb and the very nature of the show was changing. The old reviews, rightly referred to as intimate, were by the mid and late 1930s beginning to give way to more serious or solemn offerings. Offerings where you needed an army of accountants to keep track of what was going on. This climate was like mother's milk to Leland Haywood, who's the first producer in this series to have served an apprenticeship as a theatrical agent. Haywood was once asked why he switched jobs from agent to producer, and he said that for years he'd been selling his artists to producers who didn't seem to know how many beans make five, or even what a bean looked like. So he figured that if he tried it, he couldn't do any worse, and he might even do a lot better. And so he did. But that kind of attitude is not likely to endear you with too many people. And as we hear the testimonies of those who were involved in one way or another with the Haywood career, we begin to sense that maybe not everybody loved him all the time. In the musical sense, he is remembered as romantic enough. The very first show he ever took a hand in had one or two promising little songs in it. Some Enchanted Evening was, of course, from South Pacific. That was the one about the United States sailors on a desert island with nothing to sustain them except the Rodgers and Hammerstein score and a plot taken from James Michener's Tales of the South Pacific. That was some way to start your producing career with a run of nearly 2,000 performances. But wait a minute. When you're as high-powered an agent as Leland Haywood was, you can't just wake up one morning and start going to a different office. What about all the clients? After all, Leland Haywood was the agent for people like Garbo, Carol Lombard, Katharine Hepburn, Astaire, David Niven, some of the biggest stars in the business. What happened to them when Haywood decided to switch to production? You get the idea that some of these stars didn't take too kindly to the way that Haywood left them in other hands. I doubt that a man like Leland Haywood was too troubled by what anybody thought of anything, provided he was successful. And he was certainly successful enough. The witnesses in next week's programme include Ginger Rogers, Julie Stein, Joshua Logan, Kitty Carlisle and Billy Wilder. And one name I haven't mentioned so far in this preview to the story of Leland Haywood, and that's the most distinguished name of the lot when it comes to American popular music. In 1950, Haywood produced a show by Irving Berlin, which told the half-true story of America's First Lady Ambassador. It was a very distinguished team, Jerome Robbins choreographing, Irving Berlin's music, and the part of the Lady Ambassador played by the hostess with the mostess, or at least the mostess when it came to vocal penetration.
I'm the chosen party giver for the White House clientele, and they know that I deliver what it takes to make them gel. And in Washington, I'm known by one and all as the hostess with the mostest on the ball. They would go to Elsa Maxwell when they had an axe to grind. They could always grind their axe well at the party she designed. Now the hatchet grinders all prefer to call on the hostess with the mostest on the ball. I've a great big bar and good caviar, yes, the best that can be found, and a large amount in my bank account when election time comes round. If you're feeling presidential, you can make it, yes, indeed. There are just three things essential. Let me tell you all you need is an ounce of wisdom and a pound of